Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. The U.S. and Russia agree to a ceasefire in Syria. The U.S. and Russia are reported to have agreed upon a plan for a ceasefire in Syria starting on Saturday. Officials and diplomats quoted by Western news agencies on condition of anonymity said the truce would exclude attacks on Islamic State and the Al-Qaeda al-Nusra Front. Earlier, the U.S. strongly condemned a series of deadly bombings in Syria claimed by ISIS, while Russia said the attacks were aimed at derailing the peace efforts. A U.S. State Department statement called them barbaric attacks and called on all parties to the conflict, especially the Syrian regime and forces supporting it, to support a cessation of hostilities that can begin to de-escalate the civil war, which continues to sustain ISIS and other terrorist groups. Police in Uganda arrested opposition leader Kizza Besigye again Monday, days after he lost a presidential election that he says was fraudulent. Jill Craig has this from Kampala for VOA.
It was the latest in a series of arrests for Kizza Besigye, who lost Thursday's elections to incumbent Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni. Besigye intended to lead a protest march from his home to the Electoral Commission. But Besigye's attorney says police arrested him the moment he went outside his gate. Attorney Peter Magella is a project manager at Chapter 4, a Kampala-based civil rights organization. He says a candidate can file a challenge to election results with the Supreme Court within 10 days of the announcement of the results.
If the ruling government believes it won the vote genuinely, let him challenge, because if there is no evidence, he will still lose in court.
Jill Craig, VOA News, Kampala.
This is VOA News. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is due in the South Sudan capital of Juba on Thursday. That'll be his second visit since the country gained its independence in 2011. Mr. Ban's visit comes as implementation of the peace agreement signed last August between President Salva Kiir and his former vice president Riek Machar is proceeding only slowly. Machar has reportedly said he will only travel to Juba to form a national unity government when nearly 3,000 of his troops and police are in the capital. Kenyan police have received at least 30 armored personnel carriers to be used in areas of the country worst hit by terrorism. As Mohammed Yusuf reports for VOA from Nairobi, security analysts say that that's a good step, but Kenya needs to do more to win the war against Al-Shabaab.
In an effort to protect and equip police officers, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta authorized 30 armored personnel carriers to be deployed in the northeastern and coastal regions to fight militants crossing into the country. Analyst Jan St. Pierre, who runs the Berlin-based security firm, Mosikon.
I think it's a very good sign. I think President Kenyatta and the Kenyan government is finally understanding that fighting a terrorist group like Al-Shabaab requires that all parties be involved and not just elite troops or the military.
The Al-Qaeda-linked group that has vowed to attack Kenya as long as its forces are still based in Somalia. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Kenya sent troops to Somalia in 2011 to fight Al-Shabaab, the Al-Qaeda-linked group that has vowed to attack Kenya as long as its forces are still based in Somalia. The partisan fight over a Supreme Court vacancy reaches the capital when the Senate gavels on Monday, VOA's Michael Bowman reports.
For weeks, or possibly the remainder of the year, the Senate will be ground zero for a ferocious battle to replace Justice Antonin Scalia, who died 9 days ago. With the ideological tilt of the Supreme Court at stake, Republicans want the vacancy filled by the next president, not Barack Obama. They have the power to withhold confirmation of any Obama nominee and run out the clock on the administration. Senate Democrats are crying foul and have the power to block almost all legislation indefinitely in protest, effectively grinding Congress to a halt. The White House is vetting potential nominees and could name a selection any day. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
The U.S. Republican presidential candidates are campaigning in Nevada with billionaire real estate mogul Donald Trump looking to win his third straight nominating contest in Tuesday's party caucuses over his main rivals, Florida Senator Marco Rubio and Texas Senator Ted Cruz. Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Zimbabwe's government has ordered 9 diamond mining companies to stop operations and leave their premises within 90 days.
That's Sebastian Mofu reporting from Harare. We'll have full details coming up. Also, police in Uganda arrest opposition leader Kizza Besigye again today, days after he lost a presidential election he says was fraudulent. And we'll find out the expectations CAR refugees in Cameroon have for their new leader. We'll have these and more coming up on Africa News Tonight, plus music from Liberia and our feature report. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Ugandan police arrested Kizza Besigye again today after the opposition leader planned to lead a protest march to the Electoral Commission in order to collect proof of the presidential election results. VOA's Jill Craig speaks with legal experts in Kampala to learn more.
It was the latest in a series of arrests for Kizza Besigye, who lost Thursday's elections to incumbent Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni. Besigye intended to lead a protest march from his home to the Electoral Commission, where he would gather evidence that he said would help him decide whether to contest his loss at the Supreme Court. But Besigye's attorney says police arrested him the moment he went outside his gate. Attorney Peter Magella is a project manager at Chapter 4, a Kampala-based civil rights organization. He says a candidate can file a challenge to election results with the Supreme Court within 10 days of the announcement of the results.
If the ruling government believes it won the vote genuinely, let him challenge, because if there is no evidence, he will still lose in court. So it defeats justice, it defeats the reason to try and block him from accessing that evidence to go to court.
Instead, Magella says security forces should have facilitated Besigye's plans.
To me, my advice would have been let police and the security agencies give him a way to look for the evidence he's looking for and make sure he's safe and the other people are safe.
Kampala attorney Robert Kirunda offers a different solution.
It is fair for the police to say that he cannot disturb the peace while doing that. Well, then what they should have done is drive the evidence to him.
Kirunda points out police arrested Besigye before he committed an offense, a so-called preventive arrest.
Now, if you say it's preventive arrest, then allow him access to counsel. But there is a clear mischief here that he is trying to address, and the mischief is that for you to put together a good presidential petition, you need credible evidence. The credible evidence can only be obtained either from the Electoral Commission or from his agents, especially if the issue here is the tallying of results. If he can do neither, he can't meet with agents, he can't meet with counsel, he cannot go to the Electoral Commission for forms, then there's a fundamentally big problem here.
According to Kampala police spokesman Patrick Onyango, Besigye was detained for mobilizing a group of youth to storm the Electoral Commission, who he said planned to cause violence in Kampala. Uganda's Electoral Commission says Museveni won Thursday's elections by a significant margin of about 60.8% to Besigye's 35.4%. The opposition has accused Museveni operatives of vote rigging, while Museveni has said a European Union observer mission was wrong and not serious after it reported the elections had been conducted in an intimidating atmosphere, undermined by a lack of transparency and independence at the Electoral Commission. Museveni has been in power since 1986, when his National Resistance Army took control of Uganda by force, pulling the country out of chaos following a guerrilla war. Jill Craig, VOA News, Kampala.
A study to determine whether the Zika virus is causing babies to be born with a birth defect microcephaly began in Brazil today. A 16-member team from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention started work in João Pessoa in northeastern Brazil. That is the epicenter of the country's Zika outbreak. Team members working with members of Brazil's health ministry and officials from Paraíba State will fan out through Paraíba tomorrow to track down babies with with microcephaly, a condition marked by an abnormally small head size, and their mothers. The team will use blood samples to help determine whether the mothers are infected with Zika. The World Health Organization declared the Zika outbreak an international health emergency February 1st. The WHO cited a strongly suspected relationship between Zika infection in pregnancy and microcephaly, although much remains unknown about Zika. Cameroon is home to more than 300,000 Central African Republic refugees who have been following with keen interest the presidential elections in their country. With Faustin Oshkeng Tuadera declared the winner, Moki Edwin Kinsiga reports on the expectations CAR refugees in Cameroon have for their new leader and how they expect to contribute to the peace process in their country.
Belmont Vieux-Ose, former lecturer at the University of Bangui, now a refugee in Garoua-Boulaye, Eastern Cameroon, campaigned for Anicet Dulagele to become CAR president. The 52-year-old says although his candidate did not win, he is urging President-elect Faustin Archange Touadéra to immediately work for peace.
Ce que le président peut faire maintenant là, moi je suggère de rassembler d'abord ses enfants.
He says the president-elect should first of all assemble all the republic's citizens because the country has so many problems. He says it is imperative for Touadéra to make sure that schools reopen fully and civil servants start working. He says in order to achieve this, the new president should invite all religious, political and community leaders to a negotiating table. He says since the elections were peaceful, his wish is that peace should return to the country. Jodia Kato, follower of former CAR President Bozizé, who was represented at the election by Anicet Dulagele, says former Prime Minister Touadéra's victory indicates CAR is not ready for reconciliation and he is not sure anyone who supports his views will have peace should they return to CAR.
Nous qui avons combattu avec le président Bozizé, nous sommes recherchés partout.
He says they who fought wars in CAR alongside former President Bozizé have been declared wanted everywhere in the world and as such, they are not sure of their security, adding that it's better for them to remain hiding in Cameroon. He says they cannot find peace if they go back to their country. Touadéra Bienvenu says though his candidate, Faustin Archange Touadéra, was declared successful, many of his supporters are still reluctant to return to CAR.
Vous savez qu'il faut d'abord qu'il y ait la paix dans le pays.
He says the first thing they need is peace, and if there is no peace in CAR, they will not return. He says even if there is peace, the decision to return should be individual because some of them who escaped had lost everything in the war and should not be forced to return. He says it will be unwise to ask a family head who has lost all of his belongings to return, because he will not be able to feed his children and send them to school. CAR has had a history of unrest since it gained independence from France in 1960. The crisis that the presidential election is expected to solve began after Muslim Seleka rebels overthrew President Bozizé in March 2013. Abuses by the rebels triggered the rise of the anti-Balaka Christian defense groups and began a cycle of killings and violence. After former rebel leader Michel Djotodia, who took over from Bozizé, resigned, the mayor of Bangui, Catherine Samba Panza, was elected interim president until presidential elections were organized. Cameroon and CAR created a joint commission to encourage refugees to return. Cameroonian-born Ekodo Roland Yannick, who works for the Joint Commission, says many of them are reluctant to go back because they have lost everything in the war.
Je ne vois pas qu'ils peuvent rentrer chez eux sitôt. Ils n'ont pas ça dans leur idée, même dans leur esprit.
He says he does not think that they will be willing to return to CAR this early. He says they want to remain in Cameroon or go elsewhere, and some of them have been applying to the United Nations High Commissioner for refugees to take them to countries like Canada and the United States of America, where they think they will find peace and jobs, which they say is better than going back to their country where they have lost their relatives and loved ones. CAR suffered more than 2 years of sectarian fighting that left thousands dead and forced nearly 500,000 people to flee to neighboring countries, with about 300,000 in Cameroon. After CAR's national elections body announced that former Prime Minister Faustin Archange Touadéra had won the country's presidential election with 63% of the ballots cast.
That's Moki Edwin Kenziga reporting from Yaoundé. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. At 16 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Police in Uganda arrest opposition leader Kizza Besigye again today, days after he lost a presidential election he says was fraudulent. And CAR refugees in Cameroon say in spite of the CAR election, they will only go home when peace returns. And for more news and information, be sure to visit our website at voaafrica.com. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is due in the South Sudan capital, Juba, on Thursday, his second visit since the country gained its independence in 2011. Ban's visit comes as implementation of the peace agreement signed last August between President Salva Kiir and his former Vice President Riek Machar is proceeding only slowly. Machar has reportedly said he will only travel to Juba to form a national unity government when nearly 3,000 of his troops and police are in the capital, with a further 1,200 police deployed to Bor, Malakal, and Bentiu. Zimbabwe's government has ordered 9 diamond mining companies to stop operations and leave their premises within 90 days. Sebastian Mofu has more from Harare.
Zimbabwe Mines Minister Walter Chidakwa says officials from the affected mines operating near the Mozambique border had declined to be part of a consolidated diamond mining company formed last year by the government. He said President Robert Mugabe's government had not renewed the company's licenses.
Since they no longer hold title, these companies were notified this morning to cease all mining activities with immediate effect. They have been given 90 days within which to remove their equipment and other valuables.
There was no immediate comment from any company official. But Harare-based independent economist John Robertson said in a telephone interview, the announcement confirmed that Zimbabwe's laws, being unpredictable, were still far from being friendly to investors. Zimbabwe officially started mining diamonds in 2009. According to the minister, the companies, largely foreign-owned, had contributed $637 million to Zimbabwe's economy. Chidakwa also said all mining in the Southern African nation would be under Zimbabwe Consolidated Diamond Company, which would have a 50% government equity in line with the country's indigenization policy. In 2007, Zimbabwe introduced indigenization, which stipulates foreign businesses cede majority control to black Zimbabweans. Mugabe says the law is meant to bring into the economy blacks who had been marginalized during colonial rule. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. A paper published today and endorsed by 26 aid agencies from the Somalia NGO Consortium says the health sector in Somalia is currently in a fragile state and needs attention by donors, development partners, and humanitarian actors. The under 5 and maternal mortality rates in Somalia are among the highest in the world. One out of every 7 Somali children dies before celebrating their 5th birthday. Mohammed of the Somali Service interviews Kevin Mackey, World Vision Somali Program Director.
Yeah, I mean, our major concern is you have the beginnings of a development process taking place, particularly in the healthcare sector. But at the same time, large parts of the country are still experiencing emergency situations, which require emergency programming. So the Somali federal government and the Federated States are beginning to put in place systems and processes for a comprehensive health sector. However, they're trying to do this in a very fragile context, whereby you have emergencies unfolding, for example, displacement in the south, but also to worsening drought conditions in the north. The problem that we have with the situation as it is right now is that the funding for emergencies, which still remains the bulk of funding in the Somalia context, is been diminishing these past few years. I think much of that has to do with the fact that there are competing crises around the world. You have, obviously, the Syria conflict and, of course, the ongoing challenges in Afghanistan and Iraq, which are drawing emergency funding, which is still the bulk of funding, away from Somalia at a very crucial time. So you have a dual crisis unfolding.
Are you coming up with a number? What are you asking for to fund Somalia health sector and development?
Well, I mean, I think the donors need to come and meet urgently. I mean, I think the HRP is requesting USD $71 million, for the health sector for 2016. And I think that that will certainly go a long way to help funding the emergency ongoing crises, but also to this much more important, probably longer-term development-style interventions. The international community, when the Somali government undertook the Somali New Deal process, had pledged their support for funding to develop the sector. And as to date, none of that emergency funding has come in place. And so you have a nascent government institution, the Ministry of Health, and it is trying to establish basic systems and processes. But at the same time, you have unfolding emergency crises which are taxing an already underfunded system.
Well, according to your report, Kevin, as of January 2016, approximately 10 hospitals have either been closed or have majorly curtailed their services across the country. Why exactly these hospitals closed? Is it for security reasons or lack of funds to operate?
With the 10 facilities that we mentioned in our paper, it's mainly due to a lack of support from the international community, whether that be NGOs that had to scale back their presence in those locations, perhaps due to funding, but I think the main challenge has been, since some of those organizations left, there hasn't been requisite funding for other organizations to come in and fill those gaps. So some of the healthcare providing NGOs in the Somalia space receive private funds, and they're able to step in and fill the very crucial gap at the tertiary healthcare provision. And when they exit, another NGO or the government or the UN needs to be able to have the funds to step in and take over those services. So a gap has developed in those hospital facilities. Some facilities are operating with simply staff who are volunteering their time with limited supplies, if at all, coming in. So it's a very complex situation. I think, you know, at the individual health facility hospital level, you have some very dedicated Somali staff members who are volunteering time, who are trying to make do with occasional drug supplies, which are made available through NGOs or through the UN. But it's not a sustainable situation.
Finally, the NGO critics say NGOs only alarm such bells when they want to put more money into their wallets and not necessarily when things are getting worse. What's your take on that?
I think that when you look at a place that's a chronic humanitarian context like Somalia, there's always a chance for people to, particularly donors and people in donating countries, to get fatigued. And they feel that perhaps the situation should be improving, et cetera. But I think it's important to point out is that in fragile contexts like Somalia, where you have nascent government institutions coming into place, where you have recurrent crises taking place, for example, emergencies related to displacement and conflict in the south, but emerging threats like drought in the north, there is a need for the international community and donors, whether they be multilaterals, whether they be governments, or whether they be private individuals or institutions, to recognize that to put in place a healthcare system that is able to respond to recurrent shocks and to become more resilient, there needs to be a dedicated amount of support. And some of that can be in funding, some of that could be in technical support, but it needs to be consistent, and it would be helpful if it was in line with the PSG5, which is for resources and services, which is part of the New Deal Compact with which the international community signed on for. So I guess that would be my response to that question, is that it's important for donors to recognize, and individuals and private citizens, that in a complex setting like Somalia, which has recurrent challenges, is just coming in to, you know, nascent ministries of health, et cetera, being put in place, that we definitely need to continue to provide them support during this process.
That was Mohammed of the Somali Service speaking with Kevin Mackey, World Vision Somali Program Director. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in Africa news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today, because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing.
So definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Police in Uganda arrest opposition leader Kizza Besigye again today, days after he lost a presidential election he says was fraudulent. CAR refugees in Cameroon say in spite of their election, they will only go home when peace returns. And a recent study finds that livestock donations significantly increase poor people's household incomes. Coming up, we have music from Liberia and our feature segment. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're beginning with a big auto race in Florida.
Kim, when American stock car racing driver Denny Hamlin was a little boy, in second grade, in fact, he wrote a letter to himself wishing for a Daytona 500 victory. On Sunday in Daytona Beach, Florida, Hamlin's wish came true. And it came true in thrilling fashion. The 35-year-old Hamlin, driving a Toyota, beat Martin Truex Jr. in a photo finish. His margin of victory was 1/100th of a second, the closest finish in the history of the Daytona 500. Afterwards, with confetti flying, Hamlin had this to say.
This was a team victory. My teammates did an amazing job all day working together, all the Toyotas. This is a proud moment for everyone at Toyota. FedEx, on my 11th try getting the Daytona 500. I don't know where that came from. I don't know what happened. I can't even figure out what I did, but it all just came together. I got the push, obviously, from the four, but this wouldn't be possible if this wasn't Toyota's sticking together all race long.
Denny Hamlin's Daytona 500 victory was also a victory for Joe Gibbs Racing. Owned and operated by former Washington Redskins football coach Joe Gibbs. Gibbs has been involved in NASCAR, the National Association for Stock Car Auto Racing, for 25 years. This marked the first time Gibbs's team won the Daytona 500 since Dale Jarrett in 1993. During his football coaching days, Gibbs led the Redskins to 3 Super Bowl trophies. Comparing his Super Bowl victories with the Daytona 500 triumph, Gibbs said, and I quote, "Most people never get to have a dream in life. I've had 2 from an occupational standpoint. I'm probably one of the most blessed guys in the world." Let's stand up for Denny Hamlin and Joe Gibbs Racing, winners of the Great American Race, the Daytona 500 in Florida.
Stand up! Stand up! Stand up!
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
The Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports.
The Sunny Side of Sports Show.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Stand up. Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
In Olympic news, let's stand up for the world champion U.S. women's national soccer team, which booked a ticket to the Rio Games in Brazil after dominating the CONCACAF regional qualifying tournament. The American women, who are bidding for their 5th gold medal in Rio, won all 5 of their qualifying matches, scored 23 goals, and shut out the opposition. With their Olympic qualifying place already assured, the USA defeated neighbor Canada 2-0 on Sunday in the tournament final in Houston, Texas. Lindsey Horan and Tobin Heath scored second-half goals for the American women. Canada also qualified for the Rio Olympics women's football tournament by finishing 2nd. Looking ahead to June, the U.S. men's national soccer team will play the opening match in the Copa America tournament. Now, usually the Copa America determines the South American champion. This year, to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the competition, the Copa America will be played at 10 venues around the United States. The tournament will feature 10 South American teams, as well as the USA and five others from the CONCACAF region. Let's take a quick look at Sunday's Copa America draw. The United States is in Group A with Colombia, Costa Rica, and Paraguay. The Americans will meet Colombia June 3rd in the tournament's opening match at Levi's Stadium in Santa Clara, California. Levi's Stadium also hosted Super Bowl 50 earlier this month, won by the Denver Broncos. Group B in the Copa America has Brazil, Ecuador, Haiti, and Peru. Group C features Mexico, Uruguay, Jamaica, and Venezuela. And Group D has Argentina, Chile, Panama, and Bolivia. Chile is the defending Copa America champion. Host Chile beat Lionel Messi in Argentina on penalty kicks last year in Santiago to win its first Copa America trophy. Joining us now with a package of sports news is the VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma. And Mark begins by catching up with a couple of South African athletes who hope to compete at the Rio Olympics in Brazil in August.
South African Hosi Tsotsane clocked 30 minutes and 22.7 seconds to win the 10 kilometers at the Best Made Road Race in the South African capital, Tshwane, on Saturday. His sights are now set on the Olympics in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil.
And the way I felt about the race today, it was fine, because now I'm looking to run at least around here in Pretoria. This Molanyana race is to build up my fitness now. Because last year I did struggle maybe two years back now with minor injuries, but now I'm glad that I can join the guys with the racing pace and everything. So.
You won this race in 2013. Last year you were second. You've come back and won again. So it says well about your fitness. What do you want to achieve this year?
Now I'm looking upon 5,000 in the track. Yeah, 5,000 meters in the track. So that maybe I can form part of the Olympic team. But now I can see the way my training is going. I'm not far. I'm still there with the guys. Maybe I can dip under my personal best of 13:30.
That was Hosi Tsotsane, winner of the 10 kilometers at the Best Made Tax Road Race, speaking in Tshwane, South Africa. Meanwhile, returning from a maternity break, South African Yvette Fancel won the women's 10 kilometers in 33 minutes and 55.3 seconds. She aims at breaking new grounds in the marathon.
It's nice to be back racing again. I try not to race a lot because the training is quite important now for preparing for London Marathon. But today was nice, a bit hot and humid out there. It was a nice race overall, and I think I can't complain. Another sub 34, so I think preparation is going well.
You've got your London Marathon, as you say, it's going to be your first big marathon. What are your projections? What time are you looking at?
Well, I've been away from the marathon quite a bit now for a few years, so I think we're going to see what the other ladies have run, because the focus is just to qualify for Rio. To make the team, you have to run a sub 230, so I think it's going to be a tough qualifier for the marathon.
What is your personal best in marathon?
A 231.
That was Yvette Fancel, winner of the women's 10 kilometers at the Best Made Road Race in Tshwane, South Africa. Host South Africa will play Mozambique in the opening encounter at the Futsal Africa Cup of Nations in Johannesburg on the 15th of April. According to the draws held here in Johannesburg, Zambia and Tunisia are also in Group A preliminaries. Egypt is seeded in Group B, which also features Libya, Angola, and Morocco. The top three teams qualify for the Futsal FIFA World Cup in Colombia later this year. I caught up with the Mozambique coach, Naimo Abdul, and asked him for his impressions of the draw.
I think that the draw has gone very well. Yes, all the team that qualified to the CAF Futsal is very good teams, and I haven't the preference. In our group, we have big teams. Each team can qualify to the final or semifinals.
Now, the Mozambique Federation, what is the target that Mozambique Federation gave you?
To qualify Mozambique into the World Cup Futsal Colombia, and that That's why you came here, and I'm sure that we'll do this. With or without difficulties, we'll be there in Colombia.
That was Naimo Abdul, the Mozambique futsal national team coach, speaking in Johannesburg, South Africa. Meanwhile, Egypt will open their campaign in Group B against Libya. They were finalists at the last edition of these futsal championships, which Libya hosted and won in 2008. Egyptian team representative Osama Shukri is clear about their expectation.
Well, I believe every team is looking forward to win the competition. It doesn't matter which team we are playing against. We are playing for the competition, for the fun. As I told you, we are looking forward to accumulate more championships.
That was Osama Shukri, the Egyptian futsal team representative. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Because this is Africa. Tami, tami, tami. This time for Africa.
I'm very, 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 very excited.
Cause this is Africa. This time for Africa.
You crave more sports news? We're here to fulfill your wishes on VOA Africa. Listen to the sunny side of sports.
Joining us once again on the sunny side of sports is Andrew Palcheski, the Voice of America's social media reporter. Sporty greetings, Andrew.
Sporty greetings, Sonny. Good to be with you.
Andrew, what is trending in the sports world on this Monday?
Well, here in the U.S. this weekend, we had the Daytona 500, huge auto race here in the U.S. in Daytona, Florida. And interestingly, I found this press release from NASCAR from their website where they're talking about ways that they're trying to connect the fans to this race. And
okay.
One of the biggest ways they're doing that is through social media, through not just Twitter and Facebook, but things like Vine, Snapchat, a lot of these new social media, trying to bring people into the race. I guess when you have cars just going round, round in a circle, you have to keep people occupied for a while. But just some of the innovative things that they're doing, using different hashtags and things, having contests, really trying to bring the fans in and connect them. So I thought that was very interesting for a sport that's certainly very popular here in the U.S. and one that's, I think, among the fastest growing here in the U.S. among fans.
In fact, we heard from Denny Hamlin, the Daytona 500 winner. Andrew, I would rate the Daytona 500 and Indy 500 as the two big auto races here in the States.
Absolutely. Certainly on social media, a lot of conversation about the Daytona 500 this weekend. And as we were talking about just before the show, there was an interesting little social media post regarding Denny Hamlin, the winner. His mother posted something that Denny Hamlin had done when he was in elementary school. It said, you know, what do I want to do when I grow up? And he said, I want to win the Daytona 500. And sure enough, he has. I think in the report that he wrote up, he said he was going to win it in 1998. So he's a few years late, about 18 years late. But nevertheless, he's won. So that was certainly getting shared around social media to say, you know, your dreams can come true. If you're a little kid out there dreaming of winning the Daytona 500 or Super Bowl or whatever else, you can certainly do so.
Write it down. Yes,
write it down now so you can share it on social media in, you know, two decades.
Andrew, I encourage our Voice of America listeners to follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. And my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. If you go to my Facebook page, you'll see a photo of Julius Irving, Dr. J, the Hall of Fame basketball player who's celebrating his 66th birthday on this Monday, February 22nd. Andrew, what else is trending in the sports world?
Well, we have a story about Lindsey Vonn. Lindsey Vonn is the famous female skier here in the U.S. And she had a race this past weekend where one of her ski bindings failed her. The ski popped off, or so she said it did anyway. So she took to social media and took a video of her taking one of these bindings and smashing it with a hammer. Certainly something that any one of us would do if we were frustrated and our equipment failed us, as she said it did. But there was one problem with this, and it was Head, the ski apparel company, ski equipment company that she's partnered with. She has a 10-year contract with them, and this binding that she smashed was one of theirs.
Uh-oh.
So they were not happy about that, her posting this video basically blaming them for her failure in that race. So she had to pull that video down from social media, had to apologize publicly to the CEO of the company and the company, because, of course, it's big money for her. It's an endorsement deal. They supply her equipment. And she says it's a valuable lesson for her on social media, how it can be very powerful, and how maybe you should take a step back if you're in the heat of the moment and very upset about something and think twice before you post something like that on social media.
And Lindsey Vonn, of course, romantically involved for a few years. I know they've now broken up with Tiger Woods, the great American golf star.
Exactly. A lot of the social media attention was on that relationship. And now it's turned to something that she's doing on the slopes. So I don't know how she feels about that. Maybe if she's happier that's not on her personal life and it's on her professional life. But in any case, you know, like I said, she's realized, I think, now that social media can be a powerful tool. And maybe take a deep breath, think about the ramifications of your posts before you send them out.
And Andrew, getting back to Tiger, I know we've talked in recent days about Kobe Bryant and some of these other big stars that have a pretty active social media presence. How would you rate Tiger on social media?
I think it depends on where Tiger is in his career. He's had, and his personal life for that matter, because he's had a lot of personal issues in his life. I think when he has those personal issues, he tries to lay low. Mm. I think for a lot of athletes, they do that. Anytime there's an athlete who's embroiled in a controversy, especially in their personal life, they try to keep quiet on social media, not to give anyone any more ammunition. But as these athletes succeed and overcome that, then they can use social media as a way to kind of rebuild their image.
Andrew Palcheski, the Voice of America's social media reporter. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
And see you on Wednesday.
See you Wednesday.
I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC. Right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, Zimbabwe's Information Media and Broadcasting Services Permanent Secretary criticizes sanctions against the country. First, here's Ivana Nat Kamara of Liberia with Egyptian, you see.
move to the beat, move to the beat, move to the beat, move to the beat, move your feet, move, 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 move your feet.
Ivana Nakamura of Liberia with Egyptian, you see. Well, in Zimbabwe, Information Media and Broadcasting Services Permanent Secretary George Charamba, he's criticized sanctions against the country. He says they are slowing down progress on a project to modernize its broadcast and data transmissions using digital rather than analog channels. Our correspondent Erwin Chifara reports.
Briefing Parliament's Information Portfolio Committee on the country's progress on digital migration, Charamba said Zimbabwe had two payments frozen in Germany as a result of the United States sanctions law.
Each time we do payments to Huawei, we have questions to answer from either directly from the American government or from European governments who are afraid of the American government. They want to know where this money is going, who the recipient is, what it is in payment of, and sometimes, even after you've given them sufficient answers for the first transaction, they still ask the same routine questions in a very boring way. And in so doing, it's not just about the tedium of having to provide them with the same answer. It is also the delay in the transactions which follows as a result.
He said the sanctions were delaying the whole process and Zimbabwe has to explain each time they make a payment to the major contractor in the digitization project, Huawei of China.
It's not that ultimately the Europeans and the Americans finally allow the money to go. It is the irritation of having to justify a transaction which is above board, which is happening in a country where there is representation of both continents, and therefore who know that we are engaging in a broadcast project. You get a sense of spite. You get a sense of gratuitous show of power.
He said Zimbabwe had engaged the Chinese over the matter, and a new facility is said to be opened in South Africa to reduce the hassles of paying through European banks. A United States public affairs official in Harare referred all questions about the issue back to Charamba. Charamba said they had just covered 34% of the digital migration, adding that Zimbabwe had upgraded its systems in border areas and its telecommunications network no longer interfered with the neighbor's system as required by international law. Charamba said the country's media laws were archaic and needed to be revamped to meet modern-day trends and to harmonize with the constitution. He said government would convene an inquiry of stakeholders to look at the Information and Media Panel of Inquiry report and the recent constitutional judgment on criminal defamation before revamping media laws. Media Institute of Southern Africa, Zimbabwe Advocates Officer Tavani Moyo said it was pleasing that government finally realized that the media laws were embarrassing.
He also outlined that in terms of the laws governing the information industry, the ACAIC, Broadcasting Services Act, and IPA, they need to be done away with. He fell short of saying they need to be done away with, but the actual word is they need to be done away with.
Meanwhile, Charamba said government would engage media owners in the country as it seeks to improve ethics in the media industry.
We will raise issues of ethics and professionalism to say, is it quite the remit of a publisher to have an editor, a publisher who becomes an actor on a matter he's supposed to report on?
Scores of journalists have been arrested under the country's repressive media laws, such as the Access to Information and Protection of Privacy Act and the Public Order and Security Act and others. From Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Working, and our engineer, Alfredo Santos, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Tanzanian organizations working in the water sector joined members of the development community in Dar es Salaam in late January to mark the successful completion of the U.S. AID-funded Tanzania Integrated Water Sanitation and Hygiene, or IWASH, program, which supplied water to more than 200,000 Tanzanians and helped another 40,000 gain access to improved sanitation in schools and homes. In addition, more than 250,000 people learned about hygiene and sanitation thanks to IWASH. The program was implemented by the Global Water for Sustainability Consortium. After 6 years of working to improve the health and economic resilience of some of Tanzania's poorest rural and small-town communities, IWASH draws to a close this month. The program supports sustainable, market-driven water supply, sanitation, and hygiene services, while also supporting the sustainable management of water resources. Working with local implementing partners, IWASH has expanded access to these services in some of the least served communities in the regions of Morogoro, Njombe, and Iringa. IWASH equipped Tanzanians to consolidate these gains over time, training more than 1,000 people in water resource management and supporting 32 Tanzanian students with their postgraduate studies in water resources. The program also worked closely with the Ministry of Water and Irrigation and the Wami-Ruvu Basin Water Office to improve sustainable management of water resources and watersheds. I am proud to say that the Wami-Ruvu Basin benefited from the IWASH program. We now have a good base, said Praxeda Kalugendu, Wami-Ruvu Basin Water Officer. We have many challenges ahead, but this program has helped us to develop tools and approaches for integrated water resource management. IWASH support allowed for the completion of an environment flow assessment and estuary studies carried out for the Wami and Ruvu rivers. The project also trained and mobilized 22 local private sector entities to carry out low-cost drilling throughout Tanzania. Access to water is essential, said Gilbert Kajuna, USAID's Tanzania Deputy Team Leader for Natural Resource Management. USAID is proud to have worked in partnership with the government of Tanzania, local NGOs, the private sector, and universities to bring productive use of water to more than 3,700 households.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.
next on Let's Talk. Bullying, are you intimidated by it? Why does it happen? What is your experience? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing bullying. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 1730 UTC right here on VOA Africa.